You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. You'll Never Believe Me, A Life of Lies, Second Tries, and Things I Should Only Tell My Therapist. This book is by Carrie Farrell, and it is reviewed by Amanda Hess. In 2009, the New York Observer published The Hipster Grifter, an article identifying a small-time scammer prowling the Brooklyn scene, extracting cash from unsuspecting men. Her name was Carrie Farrell, and she was 22 and immensely charming. She left a flurry of notes in her wake, cocktail napkins etched with sexually explicit jokes, sometimes signed Korean Abdul-Jabbar. It worked as long as her marks didn't Google her name and find that she was wanted for felony fraud in Utah. Once exposed and detained, Farrell became a recurring obsession on Gawker.com. Napkins were auctioned on eBay. Nude photos appeared online without her consent. Though she briefly penned a jailhouse column, her motivations remain mysterious. She was flattened into a filthy, erotic character, and then she disappeared. In fact, Farrell herself did not know why she was driven to lie and steal, but she seems to have spent much of the next 15 years figuring it out. She has reemerged with You'll Never Believe Me, her captivating, sharp, and very funny memoir. The hipster grifter story launched a genre of tales featuring young women labeled scammers who revealed some hypocrisy of their spheres. Elizabeth Holmes, The Scam of Startups, Anna Delvey, New York Society, Carolyn Calloway, Social Media. Internet tabloids made Farrell into an avatar of the depravity of millennial excess in gentrifying Brooklyn. But her untold story is a great American tale, and as she unspools it, she builds an indictment of the country's central myths, the scams of race, of class, of justice. It begins when she is born in South Korea and adopted by Americans. Farrell's parents are white, as is everyone around her in Salt Lake City. She remembers a woman approaching her as a small child in the grocery store and leaning in to say, "You must be so grateful that your parents saved you." The message? Her very existence in this country is provisional. She needs to earn her keep. Her identity develops into a bluff. When she realizes in adolescence that she is attracted to girls as well as boys, she adopts a boy-crazy bravado to suppress the thought. From the beginning, she writes, "I faked being white, faked being a good Mormon girl, faked being straight." Now older and viciously self-aware, Farrell compares her past self to a competitive hot dog eater, moved to cram and cram her feelings inside until she's about to explode. In high school, she shoplifts from superstores to fit in with a straight-edge crowd. Then she starts stealing from the punks themselves, kiting checks and inventing chaotic excuses to cover her trail. She leverages her grifts to make herself appear useful, snagging friends, tickets to shows, or treating them to dinner at Benihana. She seems driven to sabotage all of her intimate relationships to confirm what she had always suspected about herself. After the cops come knocking, she skips bail and runs to New York with only a stack of American Apparel separates. With an inflated resume, Farrell lands an assistant job at Vice magazine, where her shaky assimilation project climbs to a dangerous new height. There, at ground zero of hipster cultural production, where the air felt electric in its indifference, Farrell endures racist diatribes from white man-children to assure them she is cool. At night, she exacts a sick kind of revenge. She seems drawn towards white guys with good hair, the same ones who would have stared through her in high school and whose bank accounts seem bloated with parental deposits. She leverages her own contested identity to reel them in with a self-deprecating wink. Farrell is on a bus to Bushwick scrolling through Gothamist when she sees her own mugshot. Her memoir crystallizes a moment in internet culture when the possibilities of the social web were just beginning to sour. Though Farrell finds friends and marks on MySpace, she can also be thwarted by a search engine and becomes an early target of a full-scale Twitter harassment campaign. She is labeled a subservient Asian and a crazy slut, the hateful specters that have haunted her whole life. It obviously didn't help that I had used these two stereotypes to my advantage to con so many people, she writes. Once jailed, she dreams of being sold to the highest bidder by an auctioneer. White on the inside, yellow on the outside, this exotic little banana will make all of your manic pixie dreams come true, she says. But it's also in jail that Farrell first feels like she can be honest. I stole a bunch of money, she yells to applause when prompted to report what she's in for. At the heart of her book is an earnest critique of the incoherent cruelties of the criminal justice system. She grows close to her cellmates, often caged for nonviolent drug offenses, and some of them pregnant. After surviving a riot that's violently suppressed, I felt not like an other, but part of a larger them, she writes. Once released, she is subjected to a parole system that seems designed to force her to reoffend. Her punishment for hipster grifting, she pleads guilty to charges including forgery and attempted identity fraud, ends up being not only jail time, but rounds of public shaming, stints of homelessness, and a vulnerability to sexual assault that only ends when she moves into a house of former army guys. She marries one of them, and they move back to Brooklyn, where she tries to live an anonymous life under her married name. She works a series of administrative jobs at uncool companies, but each ends when HR discovers her past. Again and again, she's denied a shot at a boring, honest life. The hipster grifter story anticipated our obsession with self-involved scammers, and now Farrell has turned that narrative on its head. Her book is generous and ambitious. She drops juicy details from her chaotic life, even as she leads us to examine forces beyond herself. It's also more evidence that she really is very charming, and that even after a gauntlet of traumas and humiliations, ones inflicted by herself and others, her biting humor survives. Her ultimate redemption is the memoir itself, proof that the story of her life is good and big enough to belong in a book, not on a cocktail napkin. I got my copy for free, but I'd gladly open my wallet for her. The reviewer, Amanda Hess, is a critic at large for the culture section of The Times, covering the intersection of internet and pop culture. Jimmy Carter, poet, novelist, memoirist, philosopher. He wasn't just prolific, publishing 32 books. His output also showed an unusual range that included memoirs and forays into historical fiction and even poetry. This review is by Rick Rojas. As a governor of Georgia harboring higher aspirations, Jimmy Carter did like many other politicians who wanted to be president. He wrote a book declaring his vision for America. After leaving the White House, he wrote another book, a memoir offering his perspective on the conflicts and crises he navigated, just as presidents before and after him had done. Then he kept writing and writing and writing. Publishing 32 books over the course of his life, he wasn't simply prolific as far as former presidents go. His output also displayed an extraordinary range that included historical fiction, poetry, and meditations on the meaning of faith and the splendor of nature. There was even a coffee table book on woodworking, a hobby of his. Of all our modern presidents, Jimmy Carter was America's most protean author, said Jonathan Karp, the president and chief executive of Simon & Schuster, which published 13 of Carter's books. The critics were not always kind. Not every book was a commercial success. Still, as a writer, Carter, who died on December 29th at the age of 100, has left behind a body of work that was vast and invaluable, researchers and those who knew him well said. His memoirs, which cover virtually every chapter of his life, could be strikingly candid and intimate. His forays into different genres revealed an embrace of adventure and willingness to take a creative risk. And taken together, his books reflect the abounding curiosity and vigor that defined his approach to life. "He took the time to really become a student before he tried to be a writer," said Craig Furman, a journalist and historian who wrote Author-in-Chief, The Untold Story of Our Presidents and the Books They Wrote. In a very craftsmanlike and humble way, when he decided to write something new, he worked to learn that genre from the inside and dedicated some time to becoming as good at it as he could be. He added, "That's the story of him as a writer, but I also think that's the story about him as a human being." In his books, Carter relived his childhood on a peanut farm in Georgia, An Hour Before Daylight, and Christmas in Plains, and outlined strategies for negotiating peace in the Middle East, The Blood of Abraham, Palestine, Peace Not Apartheid, and We Can Have Peace in the Holy Land. He explored religion and spirituality, faith, a journey for all, and discussed his favorite Bible verses and ruminated on the joys and pleasures that balance out the challenges of growing older, the virtues of aging. He decried unfair and criminal treatment of women around the world, a call to action, and celebrated the woman who raised him, Lillian Carter, our remarkable mother. Then, at the age of 90, he pumped out another memoir, A Full Life. The books were not just creative outlets. He came to rely on them as an important source of income, especially after he refused to join corporate boards or give paid private speeches, the kind of lucrative opportunities other presidents capitalized on after leaving office. Jimmy Carter is very proud of his writing and proud he could be productive enough to make a living at it, said Jonathan Alter, the journalist whose 2020 book, His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life, was one of the most comprehensive biographies of the former president. He didn't have to do what other presidents do. In 1981, he was 56, his political career torpedoed in what should have been its prime as economic turmoil and foreign crises dashed his hopes for a second term. Returning home to Plains, his tiny Georgia hometown, and a struggling family business, he dived into writing, Keeping Faith, a memoir of his presidency. Other presidents had opted to have ghostwriters and teams of researchers. He declined, but he did buy a $12,000 word processor, a primitive computer the size of a large microwave, saving his work to disks that could each hold 30 pages of writing. He stuck to a strict schedule, rising at 5:15 a.m., having a glass of grapefruit juice, and then sitting down to write. His goal is not to defend himself, said Stephen H. Hockman, who was Carter's sole research assistant on the book and is now the director of research for the Carter Center, but to explain himself, to tell what happened, and to set a basic story about himself. But as he evolved into writing about other parts of his life, his upbringings in Plains, his faith, the ups and downs of aging, his voice as a writer relaxed, his tone becoming less presidential and more approachable. An Hour Before Daylight, a memoir about his childhood, was one of his most widely praised books and a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize for biography in 2002. "It's very restrained," Furman said. "It's very simple. It's a book that shows and doesn't tell." In it, Carter wrestles with the racial dynamics of rural Georgia and the shadow of the Civil War, which still loomed over his family and everyone around him. "I grew up in one of the families whose people could not forget that we had been conquered, while most of our neighbors were black people whose grandparents had been liberated in the same conflict," Carter wrote. "Our two races, although inseparable in our daily lives, were kept apart by social custom, misinterpretation of holy scriptures, and the unchallenged law of the land as mandated by the United States Supreme Court." While other books may not have had the same literary quality or level of acclaim, they also help showcase his intellectual stamina and the expansiveness of his interests. With the exception, perhaps, of his collection of Native American arrowheads, he probed virtually every other passion or facet of his life as a writer. He's the closest we've had to a Renaissance man in the presidency since Thomas Jefferson, Alter said. When Carter decided to pursue poetry, he studied with accomplished Southern poets, digging in to understand how the form worked in an almost scientific way. He engineered poetry, Alter said. Yet, as someone who was often criticized for a certain emotional detachment, particularly in his writing, honest, sincere, intelligent, dry, humorless, and impersonal, was how a critic from the New York Times Book Review summed up his post-presidential memoir, Carter saw the project as a way to open up. He told me at one point that he only knew how to express his true feelings in poetry, Alter said. The result was Always a Reckoning and Other Poems, a collection of 47 short poems that was published in 1995. Publishers were not entirely receptive. He was offered an advance of $75,000, a significant sum for poetry, but less than what presidents are often paid for books. The reviews were tepid. Michiko Kakutani, writing in the Times, called him a mediocre poet, and it left him exposed to mockery. There was a lot of scoffing at Jimmy Carter in those years, Alter said. Despite that, the book sold well, and people close to Carter noticed in his poems shades of vulnerability that they had rarely seen elsewhere. He once said that even his wife, Rosalind, was surprised by one he had written about his father. This is a pain I mostly hide, but ties of blood or seed endure, and even now I feel inside the hunger for his outstretched hand, a man's embrace to take me in, the need for just a word of praise. But writing had also created strains in his marriage. Everything to Gain, which was supposed to be a co-written account of Jimmy and Rosalind Carter's lives after leaving the White House, caused so much friction between them that their editor had to travel to Plains to make peace. They each wrote their own version, and they vowed they'd never work together again, Alter said. Both of them described it to me as one of the low points of their marriage. He also encountered turbulence over the title of his book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, published in 2007. Alice Mayhew, the venerated nonfiction editor who worked with him on this and other books, tried to persuade him to not use the word apartheid. But he did not budge, and the book prompted a backlash from critics who saw it as incendiary and unfair to Israel. A longtime advisor resigned in protest, as did members of a community board at the Carter Center. He defended the book, but later lamented the friendships he had lost over it. Carter also ran into the usual frustrations of writers. There were moments when editors prevailed, like when they said, The Hornet's Nest, his novel about the Revolutionary War, was too long. In the acknowledgments, he conceded he had to cut it back with some pain and reluctance. He also had to weather a minor crisis when his word processor malfunctioned, causing hours of work to vanish. But Lynn Nesbitt, who had been his literary agent since a meeting in the Oval Office, said he could be very different than many other writers. He was decisive. He couldn't afford to spend that much time agonizing, she said. He also did not fret over how his work would be received. He already played on the biggest canvas in the world and had people knock him and criticize him, Nesbitt said. What did he care about what a New York Times critic said? The reviewer, Rick Rojas, is the Atlanta bureau chief of the New York Times, covering the South. I'll Come to You, by Rebecca Kaufman. This book was reviewed by Claire Luchette. And then there is Using Everything, Gertrude Stein said of her approach to composition. For Rebecca Kaufman, there's Using Everyone. The novelist is interested in Congress. Friends reunite, families meet up, exes come together, and there's something to be seen from each character's vantage point. Her 2022 novel, Chorus, was told from 9 points of view. Her narration never stays in the same place, or even the same brain, for too long. In her 5th novel, I'll Come to You, set somewhere in the American Midwest, We first meet Ellen, a genial, selfless, newly divorced school bus driver in January 1995 on a reluctant date with a retiree named Gary. She orders chicken. He gets steak. She makes up a story to explain the divorce she still doesn't understand. By the end of the evening, Gary and Ellen agree he's not dating material, and she has reached a conclusion. Next Christmas must be spent together, the whole family, her future grandchild and ex-husband included. As the clock starts ticking, subsequent chapters spotlight members of Ellen's extended family. Her son, Paul, and daughter-in-law, Corrine, anxious in the early days of their yearned-for pregnancy. Corrine's father, Bruce, who keeps a notebook of memories and thoughts for the baby amid his cognitive decline. And Corrine's mother, Janet, who takes pains to give the impression, at least in photos, that she and Bruce are still in their prime. Then there's Corrine's brother, Rob, a car salesman whose compulsion for lying brought an end to his marriage. Though the chapters indicate a monthly chronology, really they take place over single afternoons or evenings, maybe a weekend at most. Kaufman gives us vignettes rather than the wide view. Each scene has its own arc. One starts with a box of Just for Men hair dye and ends with a man asleep next to a jar of pickles. One character takes up God and puts him back down within the span of a car ride. The reader learns to do away with expectations of continuity. Early on, Corrine is shocked to learn a family friend is queer, and his characterization is cringingly homophobic, and then we pivot away just as quickly, never returning to him again. The peripatetic third-person narration brings to mind Nabokov's critique of the peri, a term he invented, etymologically related, he suggested, to the word periscope. For the narrator who serves merely to do the author's bidding, a tour guide through the places which the author wishes the reader to visit and meet the characters whom the author wishes the reader to meet. Every narrator does the author's bidding, but there are times when it feels like neither Kaufman nor her narrator can say for sure why they're moving us in one direction or another. Except, perhaps, for pure entertainment. It might be more apt to say that Kaufman's narrator functions like a Nintendo character, hopping from one block to another, disappearing down the pipes of a character's mind. With Kaufman at the controller, we boing ahead a month at a time to meet a new individual and learn what drives, spooks, and delights them. And the joy in this book is something to admire deeply. The corrections-esque pressure of one last Christmas might herald only the hard truths of family togetherness, and Kaufman does provide, with exquisite precision, all the toxic snits, the petty furies, the lure of nostalgia, the gnaw of needs never met. But she insists, too, on granting each character, siloed though they may be, their share of wins. The delights aren't cheap, either. Kaufman loves them enough to bestow upon them the genuine, radiant, quiet, don't-blink kind of happiness. She shows us there is room in a novel, as in the heart, for everyone. The reviewer, Claire Luchette, is the author of the novel Agatha of Little Neon. Staffers at the Times on the books they enjoyed in 2024. Loved and Missed by Susie Boyd. This book was reviewed by Elizabeth Kennedy, White House editor. I don't know why I picked up Loved and Missed. It must have caught my eye through some sort of bookstore magic, because I had never seen it before and I didn't recognize the author's name. I had a professor in college who said novels remind us of what it means to be human. This is a book that does exactly that. It's about a woman named Ruth who takes in her granddaughter because her daughter is hopelessly addicted to drugs. Actually, she doesn't just take her in. Ruth hands over an envelope of cash to her addled daughter and backs away fast with a baby in her pram. If you think that sounds sad, you're right. But Ruth carries on, warmly and often hilariously. I've never read a better account of loving an imperfect, damaged person. The years roll by and normal things happen, but there is always an undercurrent of nerves pulsating, love and anxiety plated with fright. Life plows relentlessly on, whether we are sad or not. Some of my favorite scenes in the book involve food: jam tarts, roasted potatoes, flapjacks with raisins, steamed clams, a perfect little roast turkey. Those scenes, in this book, remind me of what it means to be human, like my college professor said. Whether in the face of calamity or continuity, everyone still has to eat. Briefly, Perfectly Human by Alua Arthur. This book is reviewed by Veronica Chambers, editor and Projects and Collaborations. When I first began to read about the term death doula, I let my eyes glaze over it the same way I do when I read the words slasher film. But last April, the term became almost impossible to avoid because Alua Arthur published an exceedingly popular book called Briefly, Perfectly Human. There, she was on CBS talking about her work as a death doula with Gail King, and again on NPR's Fresh Air with Tanya Mosley. I was intrigued by the interviews, but I still wasn't sure a book about dying people was my next spring read. So I watched her TED Talk and then finally purchased the book on Audible. Listening to the book was wonderful. It is part the author's memoir of how she came to be a death doula and also the stories of all the people she has helped at the end of their lives. It was warm, thoughtful, and often funny, the gallows humor. It is the most important book I read in 2024 because it taught me, deeply, that thinking about death can be an opportunity to more fully embrace life. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.